This summer, we enter a new era of Star Wars.
You mean the dawn of the Star Wars canon timeline podcast?
Yeah, sure, that too. But I was obviously talking about The Acolyte. We've got to cover that on the Lorehounds.
Oh, but the Star Wars canon timeline podcast is exactly at that point in the timeline, the end of the High Republic, 100 years before the prequel trilogy. We've got to cover it there.
Why not both?
Okay, deal.
It's the first live-action Star War outside the Skywalker saga. Nobody can miss this.
Listeners, kick off your hot lore summer weekends with scene-by-scene breakdowns of The Acolyte, found in both the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast and the Lorehounds Mother Feed.
And the Lorehounds Star Wars Feed.
Wherever you like to listen, a couple of days after each new episode is released.
Research request granted. Spoilers unlocked.
Welcome back, Beacon Heads, to Wool Shift Dust, the adaptation analysis podcast that has the guts to ask the would-you-rather questions no one else thought care about. Who's asking what, you ask? I'm Alicia, your host, here to drop Beacon 23 spoilers and grill my co-host Luke on everything Beacon 23, like, Luke, would you rather be a potentially immortal personal AI under Aleph's thumb, or an AWOL super soldier with memory gaps on the run?
I think an AWOL super soldier with memory gaps on the run, to be honest. I mean, neither of them are particularly appealing choices, but I think I'm going to go with super soldier. At least you'll be able to beat people up in cool and interesting ways.
Okay. Luke, would you rather enter the artifact and get all the answers, but never be able to come back? Or live out your life in our universe, never to know?
Oh, definitely enter the artifact, but not be able to come back. I need answers.
We need a season 3.
I need closure, damn it.
Okay, my turn. I am going to go with the potentially immortal personal AI under Aleph's thumb, because as we saw from Harmony, for special cases, there might be a way out. Or you just piggyback on someone who's special, like Dev did. And for the other, I don't know. Can I like hook up with the artifact at the end of my life?
No, yeah, that's cheating. That's cheating. That's like a deathbed conversion. That's just right. That's just cheating.
Do I get to bring my 5 best buddies with?
Yeah, I think you get to bring your 5 best buddies with you. I think the 4 people you've
the 4 best buddies. Yeah. Okay. Then I guess I'm going in.
Okay.
All right. So, listeners, our spoiler policy for this episode is the same spoilers for every episode. There will be spoilers for both seasons of Beacon 23, of course, every episode that's ever aired. And as the resident Hugh Howey book reader on this podcast, I reserve the right to bring up any bits of the book I feel are pertinent. Don't expect too many, but I won't spoil the ending just in case there are more seasons or you want to read the book yourself. Abby and I did do a full breakdown of the book in the book club, so you'll find that link in the show notes if you want to check that out. And this is our wrap-up of season 2 of Beacon 23, the potential final season? We don't know. I have an interview with season 2 co-showrunner Glenn Matsar later today, as Luke and I are recording. You'll hear that later this ep, though. But first, Luke and I wanted to talk through another interesting interview Matsar had with 3 hosts in a beacon, the podcast sponsored by Boat Rocker, the production company. So you'll find that link in the show notes as well. Luke, what did you, I know you gave that interview a listen. What did you think? Did anything stand out to you?
I mean, I think the extent to which Glenn Matsar is just happy for the audience to draw their own conclusions on like a really wide range of stuff, which I find kind of, which I've got to be honest, I find a little bit frustrating. My attitude is very much, you're the writer. I want to know what you think. But I also thought that the discussion towards the end of the interview, where they talk about the role of AI in society and getting Glenn Matsara's sort of views on that, was quite interesting. I thought he made a really good point about AI sort of drawing on human history and how that might mean that you've got to be careful that AI doesn't replicate like the worst parts of human history. And you can already see that with the way that algorithms push content on social media. So I thought that was a really good point, and something that doesn't get talked about often enough in the debate over AI. It's the old adage of, you know, IT, garbage in, garbage out. So yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that was a good point.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't really get the sense that he was confident that there was going to be a third season. I think he kind of hopes there's going to be a, I mean, I'm
he
sure you'll ask,
are still built,
I'm sure you're
going to
ask him later on.
Sure, but, of course. Yeah, I got to shoot my shot, but I'm sure he doesn't know. So he did kind of answer all of our more nitpicky questions about continuity with the phrase dream logic.
Again, I thought that's a bit of a Weasley. That's a bit of a Weasley.
I
don't,
but
Glenn.
You know, like I don't hate it, because first of all, it does fit with the feel of the show. Is it's very dreamy. It's always been a very dreamy show, even though we don't have the tripping on guib juice this season. And I was also just discussing this week's episode of Doctor Who, which kind of like their thing this season is there is a villain, no spoilers, but a villain says, I've rewritten your whole history. So it's like, oh, so anything that doesn't make sense is because.
this is the thing, like the Doctor Who is notorious for that. Like it has always done that.
So I don't hate dream logic, and that's okay. Then like I don't need to worry about the doctor saying he was leaving and then being at work again. Like that's fine.
Yeah. Also, like when you sent me the link for the show, I'm always a bit sort of, you know, my natural attitude towards podcasts that are sponsored by the production company is to tend to avoid them.
Okay.
But I actually thought I don't know the host, but I actually thought they did a good job of like asking Glenn Matsara the questions you'd want answered. Because I always feel like if they're sponsored by the production company or they're sponsored by HBO, you know, am I just going to get 40 minutes of rah-rah, basically?
Right.
But they didn't do that.
Right. Yeah, they did directly ask a question. They dashed the hopes of a theory that I've been supporting on this podcast, which is that harmony equals hope. And Glenn Matsara said, harmony is definitively not hope. It was a different actress. I don't know why she's not credited.
I still think if you listen to that, that's Natasha Mumba's voice. If not, it's somebody that sounds remarkably like Natasha Mumba.
I don't know why they wouldn't credit her, but this is what he says. So, we also found out Joy Blake did a lot of the things that I liked about the ending. Like she pushed for the Harmony Transcendence storyline, and the Harmony and Aster on the stairs moment was apparently her, and also bringing Halen's father back into the fold. And it sounds like Glenn Matsara is most proud or excited about his contribution of the creature. So that creature we see at the very end, the jellyfish kind of creature, he says it's his first creature design that made it to the air. He did create one for a Dark Tower pilot that never aired. Did you feel vindicated when you heard? So first of all, he worked on it with Weta, which is the New Zealand, you know, that's the special effects company that's set up to do Lord of the Rings, basically, and does a lot of the best work in the business. But yeah, did you feel vindicated when you heard he said it could have opened its mouth and had 1,000 teeth?
Yes. Yeah. Because like, I thought for a second that was exact. Not necessarily the 1,000 mm-hmm. teeth, but I definitely thought right. it was like going to open up. And yeah, I like the sort of description of it being like Lynchian rather than like Lovecraftian. It didn't occur to me when I was watching the episode, but yes, sort of Lynchian is a good way to describe it.
Yeah, speaking of dream logic, like I've spent I don't know how many hours analyzing Mulholland Drive just because, yeah, that film's all dream logic. Yeah, so, and he confirmed that it's a jellyfish because of the nautical/lighthouse theme. And about the opening its mouth, he said it could have opened its mouth and had 1,000 teeth and be threatening, but he didn't want that. He wanted a sense of wonder, something mysterious, which, yeah, that worked. That happened.
Yeah.
And he cited Steven Spielberg as an influence, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, so, I was sort of thinking...
I think more in the sense of wonder aspect.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking maybe Close Encounters of the Third Kind, if you were looking for something specific.
Yeah, probably. Good call. Yeah, and I guess this is where you felt your frustration. He talks about that Young Astor cliffhanger, which I said right after the episode aired, I think we might not see this resolved and we have to connect the dots, and I don't mind that. But he did say, yeah, he wanted to leave that up to the audience.
Yeah, I thought the explanation of this is showing Astor's empathy for Halen, basically, that you can be in, to use a Star Trek metaphor, you can be in that the sort of Kobayashi Maru type scenario, the no-win scenario where something bad has got to happen. And yeah. it's up to you to decide what that bad thing is. Mm-hmm. Which I kind of get. Although if you were just doing it for that reason, I think it would have probably been just as effective to have Astor, Lena Headey sit down to Eowyn and explain it. I don't think you needed the bulk of an entire episode, considering the limited run of the series, just to set that up.
But I think that's not the only thing it set up. That's just maybe what he considered the most important thing that it set up.
Yeah, mate, yeah.
And I did find it interesting, by the way, you were talking about the conversation in this interview about AI, and he said that he wrote the Dosto character, and that does kind of reflect his more skeptical views of artificial intelligence.
Yeah. Yeah, but obviously Dosto doesn't meet a particularly happy fate at the hands of AI.
Yeah, so, sorry, Jocko, right?
Jocko, yeah. Jocko. Yeah, sorry,
I meant yeah. Jocko, the beacon keeper, sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
And also he clarified for the timeline that the Astor flashback, it takes place before her going to the QTA. So this results in her being with the QTA. And so this is before she met Harmony.
So I wonder whether that's Aleph like picking up on, you know, the logs of the beacon and going, this person is interesting. You know, maybe we want to go out and recruit her because, you know, she's capable. She's capable of thinking on her feet. She's got a certain moral flexibility at that point, which is useful for the QTA's purposes. Right.
Well, we can definitely see that with the soldier experiments that, you know, Aleph is thinking violence is the answer, and she showed a willingness to resort to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, he also clarified that Harmony is the one, although, yeah, this was more Joy Blake's storyline. He said Harmony is the one to connect out of all of them with the artifact because she often took the best of humanity. And that the Riff, he called them the Riff, which is what the aliens who look different in the book, but that's what the aliens are called. He said they needed a being that wouldn't threaten them. So we picked that last part up, but do you think Harmony took the best of humanity out of all the characters?
I mean, I think the other thing he said was that Harmony is capable of feeling emotions, but not necessarily acting on them.
Mm-hmm.
So she has like the AI ability to feel anger, but also to sort of wall that anger off and not be controlled by it.
Yeah.
Which I actually thought was the more interesting part of that, which is the harmony's got like full emotional range, but mm-hmm. not. But because she is an artificial life form, she's capable of feeling those emotions, but not letting them control her actions.
Mm-hmm.
So being like, again, it comes back to, this is, I have a tendency to bring everything back to Westworld because I'm just not over that yet. I just haven't recovered from that. But it's the same thing with the hosts in Westworld. They have the ability to feel all these emotions, but also mm-hmm. the ability to recognize that they are emotions, that they aren't mm-hmm. rational, and that they can sort of act without acting on those emotions necessarily. Mm-hmm. So they're not controlled by them. And I thought that was the more interesting part of that part of the conversation for me. Because yeah, if you are going to develop a fully sentient AI,
mm-hmm.
one of the advantages that they will have over humans is they might have the ability to feel emotion, but not necessarily be ruled by it.
Hmm.
Humans can't do that.
Okay.
We think that we can, but uh-huh. we generally can't.
Our hormones are in the way. I don't know. Well, there are sociopaths amongst us.
Yeah, it's true.
I do think the overall conclusion I took from this interview was that this is, and I guess, you know, I always had this sense, this is a story more about characters than a story about the world. So any world building we get is kind of like bonus sprinkles, but it's just more about who is drawn to this beacon and why, who, and how does it change them?
Yeah. What I thought was quite interesting is that Glamazara, and this is maybe something you can touch on in the interview later, he was quite explicit about what the division of labor between him and Joy Blake was mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, which parts of the story came from which, mm-hmm. from which writer. And he was also quite explicit about the stuff, and that in season one, that he didn't retcon, but that he just right. wanted to take in a slightly different direction.
Because
I think it's a unique situation where you have two seasons filmed back to back, but with right. different mm-hmm. showrunners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. No, I'm definitely curious about the act of taking over a show like this. So Three Houses and a Beacon also recently interviewed Natasha Mumba, who plays Harmony. And it was, I recommend that interview as well. It was really nice to hear about her friendship with Lena Headey. And I had no idea that Headey is now married to the actor who played Keir.
Really?
Yeah. So Mark Menchaca is his name. And they were engaged when they were filming this.
Oh, that's awesome. Can you imagine reading the script for the final episode of season one?
I wonder what was like, did she bring him? I mean, he's a, you know, working actor in his own right, does lots of stuff. But I have to wonder if it was coincidence that he was there. Seems unlikely, right?
Yeah, it seems
like she's like, hey, how about, you're looking for this part.
I know somebody that would be perfect for the role.
Yeah.
Also, he gets to kill me.
That would be kind of fun, right?
Yeah.
You could throw that back in his face anytime you fight. Remember when you killed me?
When you blew my head out.
So yeah, that's a fun fact. And apparently they're still close friends, Natasha and Lena. So that's lovely to hear.
Okay, that's cool.
So I did reach out to Hugh Howey as well for anyone who's curious, just to check in with him at the end of the season. And he's having a busy summer on the road. But he said something else. I want to quote directly from his email to you. So he said, It would be right now super difficult for me not to spill the beans on Silo stuff now that I've seen season two. So season two is done. He's seen it. He said, we're going to have a Silo panel at San Diego Comic-Con this year with some great panelists and should be announcing some interesting news and casting stuff. So he said, well, we'll have to talk more when I'm allowed to speak about that. So basically, So, Luke, you and I are basically confirmed. San Diego Comic-Con is taking place end of July. You and I got to get back on the mics early August to talk about reveals.
Yeah, to talk about. I did, in a similar vein, I did read a magazine interview with Rebecca Ferguson where she was saying mm-hmm. she'd seen Rough Cut of season two. But there were,
okay.
There were,
yeah, there were I'm lot, sure. I mean, obviously, it's not polished or finished.
Yeah, there were a lot of. There were apparently a lot of effect mm-hmm. shots that needed sure. finishing, which she's seen the Rough Cut.
Right. Yeah. No. The special effects is always the last thing to finish because it's what polishes the scenes. It's what takes the most time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it has to. Everything else has to be in place before you can finish that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I'm thinking that we probably get early first quarter next year is my prediction for season 2.
Yeah, I would say sort of. Maybe I was thinking maybe sort of January, February, mm-hmm. around that time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But we'll find out more end of July. So Silo fans, stay tuned.
Yeah.
As for now, I'm going to go get ready for my interview with Glenn, our Mr. Matsara to me. any final questions for him, Luke?
I mean, obviously, the overriding question is, when is season 3? Give us season 3.
Yeah, okay.
I need more seasons.
I promise the word season 3 will be uttered.
Yeah, there was one question that sort of occurred to me while I was listening to the Three Hosts and the Beacon podcast. How much of Milan is left in Aelith? Does he think? Okay. Is Aelith, by the time we see him in the show, just walking around in a Milan suit, basically? Mm. Or are they, you know, how far has Aelith pushed beyond Milan, the template mm-hmm. he was based on, basically?
Okay. All right. I added that to the list. So.
Cool.
Listeners, you will be hearing that question and all my other questions right after a short break. And then Luke and I will be back to chat about the interview and some quick final feedback. So see you all on the other side. I am here with co-showrunner of season 2 of Beacon 23, Glenn Matsara. Glenn, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I know it's early, your time.
All good.
Now, I already listened to and talked to my host about the interview that you did with Three Hosts and a Beacon, the podcast sponsored by Boat Rocker. So I won't repeat the questions that I heard there, but that was really interesting. I included that note in the show notes for everyone else. But yeah, I just was hoping to pick your brain a little bit more about the season and about show running duties in general. I know... You have done a lot of different shows before. Probably a lot of people will first mention The Walking Dead, where mm-hmm. you took over for Frank Darabont and did the first 3 seasons. I actually coincidentally am in the middle of watching Damien.
I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, no, I'm 4 episodes in, and so far episode 3 is my favorite, and I love Barbara Hershey.
She's fantastic. I love Barbara. That's great. Enjoy.
She turned up also in Beacon. Was that a link with you or just a coincidence?
Oh, no, it was. Barbara and I are friends. And, you know, and we had this idea for this prequel episode. And as we were thinking about who would be great for that, because it's a lot of pressure to, you know, mm-hmm. as a 2-person play, who would be fantastic. And you know, I just think Barbara is underused. I think she's such a terrific actor.
Absolutely.
And I wish she, what's that?
Magnetic.
Yeah, and I wish she worked more. So I sort of, you know, called her and said, hey, would you do this? And she was actually in Europe, and then she went to New York and went to Martin Scorsese's 80th birthday, and then came right after that, came to Toronto and just sort of jumped in. And it was just a fantastic experience working with her, as always.
Yeah, that's the life. So Walking Dead... Damien, which for anyone who doesn't know, set in the Omen universe, and Beacon 23, they're all 3 different types of adaptations. But how was the process different from the showrunner perspective? How did you think about each of them differently?
That's a great question. I think with a little bit different, and I've also adapted. I shot a pilot for Stephen King's Dark Tower.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I shot that. So I wrote something else based on a King thing. So I've done several, you know, adaptations. And my approach is first always understand and honor the original artist's intent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what are they trying to get to? What are they trying to say? Because, you know, their work already exists. So I don't think we're just going to do a filmed version of that.
Right.
I don't think the audience really wants that. You want to be surprised, and yet you want it to honor that. And I find, particularly with genre, genre fans really reject material if they feel you're not respecting the underlying material, mm-hmm. if you don't care about it. So you really want to make sure that if you have the opportunity, speak to the original artist, understand what their motivation was, what was their inspiration, what were they trying to go for.
Right.
Okay. So the adaptations I've done, I've come to as a fan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was a fan of, I didn't know the comic book Walking Dead, but I knew horror movies. I was a fan of Frank Darabont. I was a fan of zombie films, that sort of stuff. So I knew that. I love The Omen. I'm a fan of horror movies. I did that with a big Stephen King fan. And with this, I'm a fan of, you know, sci-fi. Okay, so I was not really familiar with, I had read Wool, Hugh's other mm-hmm. novel, but I was not familiar with this. So I was a Hugh fan, and I spoke with Hugh about this, you know what I mean? I spent time talking to King about his material, you know. I really kind of broke down The Omen and The Omen universe and all of that when I was doing Damien. So I think first you want to understand their original intent. You want to come at it as a fan.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third thing you need to do is you need to find some personal connection to the material.
Right.
You need to find out, why am I the person telling this story? You know, and so a lot of times I get offered adaptations, and if I don't feel that it resonates with me in some personal way, I pass on the project and get out of the way and assume some other writer could do a much better job. So with Beacon 23, you know, we would just come in, you know, when we're shooting this, the pandemic was still going on. So we're dealing with questions of isolation, being trapped with people who mm-hmm. may be driving us crazy, worried about us losing our own minds during the isolation. That felt very, relevant to me, the terror of being out there on the edge of the unknown, that really, you know, I felt there was something there about that. So I tried to kind of find the personal connection, and I was hopefully, you know, was able to find one here in this material.
Mm-hmm. So your personal connection in this case was the identifying with that sense of isolation that we were all kind of going through at the time.
Yeah. And you know, and I signed on at the end of season one. You know, there were already scripts written for season one. They were mm-hmm. shooting season one and rolling into season two. And I was friendly with Zach. I had known mm-hmm. Zach Penn, the original writer and creator of this show, and wanted to work with him and everything. So, you know, I joined on to work with him, to help him, mm-hmm. you know, support him, that sort of stuff. And, and then I think you find the connection. And then, you know, being a science fiction fan, you try to think about, as you're going through, well, what have I seen and what have I not seen? And how can I mm-hmm. push this? How could I make this a little bit different? You know, what would really exist under these circumstances, that sort of stuff. So it was a very creative experience. This one was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So you and Joy Blake split showrunner duties this season. Mm-hmm. How did mm-hmm. that break down practically? Like, were you passing things back and forth or sitting down in a room together to talk things through?
It shifted by what the needs were, because this one was, I think, because it was such a big, expensive show. You know, there were a lot mm-hmm. of visual effects. That set was pretty magnificent, all of that. And we were, you know, shooting the end of season one, and we were going into season two, and there were a lot of questions about the material for season two. I had worked with Joy several times, okay, before. We had worked on a show together. We had, that's how we met. It was a Criminal Minds spinoff. She was my number two on Dark Tower. So mm-hmm. I had two different rooms for that, you know, just because right. it was such a long process. She ran both of them. And we've talked about, you know, developing a project together. We looked at doing a horror novel together. We were adapting. Okay. She's a terrific writer. So we were interested in working together. And I think what happens is that a lot of newer showrunners, since these things are so expensive to run, a lot of women and people of color don't get invested in as showrunners.
Right.
So it was always my intent to sort of work with Joy. And I was like, well, I could teach you how to be a showrunner, and then, you know, you could just take over, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or, you know what I mean? And you could learn the craft of showrunning. Because the first time you run a show, it's very, very, it's always challenging. But right. the first time you're running a show,
you're figuring it out. Yeah.
It's just a lot of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So there were questions in season one where, you know, we had different timelines. We had some material that really worked. We had other material that didn't work. And if that had to be cut, then pieces from other episodes needed to be moved around. So it was so editing season one was very fluid. I have a lot of experience editing. So I said, well, I'll edit season one and kind of move that stuff around. And you take point on season two and learn okay. how to prep all the stuff and, mm-hmm. you know, run the room. And sometimes I would jump into the room, you know, but she really ran the points. You know, we figured out what the staff was. We were both working for Zach. When I started working for Zach, I asked Joy right. if she wanted to come on. So, and then we mm-hmm. were both elevated. So what happened was she really kind of took the point and sort of worked out the whole harmony arc and all of that. You know, she wrote the last two episodes a lot. There was a writer for episode seven who did a great job. But Joy, you know, was very instrumental in sort of helping her break that story. Joy right. wrote the last episode, and then right. and then I wrote the Sabaran episode, you mm-hmm. know, just to have an episode in the thing. So that was kind of my episode, and I did produce that episode. But really, the rest of it was Joy. I did work with people with the two writers to work on the Asta flashback,
right?
Mm-hmm. You know, but really, I think Joy was kind of the point person on season two. And then after we wrapped the show, then it moved into editing, and I did a lot of the editing to try to get as much of that done. And we did get all the editing done before the writers and actors strikes.
Mm-hmm.
We prepped and did all of that. So I really kind of handled the post, and she handled the writing, with the exception of the Sabaran episode. You know.
Right, because during the strikes, neither of you could weigh in on decisions or anything like that, correct?
That's correct.
So, the Writers Guild.
Right. So the way that worked was the day before the strike. So the strike was called on May 2nd mm-hmm. of 2023. So on May 1st, I met with everybody over Zoom. I'm in Los Angeles, and the post crew was predominantly in Toronto.
Right.
And I just said, look, you know, we have everything up to a certain point,
mm-hmm.
and it looks like tomorrow I'm going to be on strike. I don't know if I'm going to be back. This might be the last time we're seeing each other, which is very mm-hmm. sad, you know, yeah. or I could be back in a week, or I could be back in 6 months. I didn't know. So I just, you know, trust yourselves. You know, you understand what the show is, you know, mm-hmm. You know, don't worry if this ends in a month and I come back, I promise I'm not going to scream and say, why did you do this or whatever. I said, well, mm-hmm. we'll make it work. And you're all talented people. And I really believe that, you know, I would love to work with those folks again. So, But then I just had to go away. And then the strike ended on September 27th. And as I was driving to a guild membership meeting, Boat Rocker called me and said, can you come back to work tomorrow and finish up post? So I went back and I was very, very pleased with everything mm-hmm. that I had seen, you know, so I had designed the alien at the end, right? I had worked with Weta and that was kind of my concept and everything. So I was really working with them and I had not seen how it moves. I had not seen mm-hmm. and none of the work had been done yet. So a lot of that was supervised by a producer, an executive from Boat Rocker, a great guy named James Middleton. And he kind of got that over the finish line. So I came back and I was just so happy with that ending. And, you know, Will and Ramin did the music. I thought they did a tremendous job. I was happy. I got to come back as a fan and enjoy the work that had been done in my absence during the strike.
Right. The making what was in your head real. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What's the best compliment that you've gotten about the show? And what's the biggest misunderstanding?
I think the biggest, compliment or the greatest joy I had with this show was just working with the people, you know, mm-hmm. like I'm explaining, it was every show you run has its challenges. Everything is difficult. Okay. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people get stressed and that doesn't always bring out people's best. And you mm-hmm. have people, you know, but I felt like people felt safe working with me. People felt good mm-hmm. working with me. People felt mm-hmm. like it was creative. We had fun. You know, there were some things that we really just laughed our asses off at, you know, it was fun. It was a fun creative experience, you know? And I think people got to do good work. So I was very happy with that. You know, okay. I was very happy with that. I think the misunderstanding is the I will say, like, say on podcasts or online or whatever, I think the misunderstanding is that people don't understand that we were trying to go for a fractured type of storytelling.
Right.
Okay. We're purposefully trying to do something different. One, because that was the nature of it, but you know, we were trying to, you know, at one point, you know, in the Rocky episode, we're in a hallucinatory state. So, so I think people kind of approached this as this was going to be a very type of standard storytelling about this little outpost. And maybe there's this big war. We don't ever show that. We don't have any, you know, ship battles or anything. We have a lot of stuff happening off screen and it's about, you know, think about how we were during the pandemic. We were getting this information of the world falling apart. We're in our apartment saying, what is going on? Mm-hmm. We were trying to capture that. We were trying to capture a sense of isolation. And we were trying to give a, so I think that we took chances and some of those chances worked better than others. But I don't think I'm not sure if people got that we were trying something different and experimental, not just being sloppy.
Right. Well, I think something that Luke and I both liked from your interview with three hosts in a beacon was you there was a reference to David Lynch, and that made me think about like how much time have I spent dissecting Mulholland Drive, which is horror, but it's a dreamy horror. It's
correct.
Yes.
So that was something that we talked about, you know, like for example, you know, you have, you come back in season two, right? Mm-hmm. And you have this episode that sort of pays off, you know, and it's a grim episode and he's sort of a prisoner locked in a tower, right? Halen is locked in a tower and he's assigned to, all he wants to do is get off the beacon. That's all he wants to do is get off the beacon. And he's trapped there. Okay, so the emotional stakes are very high. I think that's a good episode. I think we kind of, you know, we pushed it. You know, the fact that Aleph, you know, kills the column people and says, you know, to use them for water. I mean, that's pretty dark, right?
Yeah.
So we pushed that, and then
we loved Darth Aleph. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you cut to you know, the next episode is Harmony. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And then you're trying to figure that out, world. And then you cut to Iris, mm-hmm. you know, and then Iris comes over and then we add the Sabarans. And so we were constantly, I think, throwing curveballs at the audience. And I think,
right.
I, so I trusted the audience. I felt mm-hmm. like the audience would respond to that. I'm not sure they did. You know what I'm saying? I'm not sure.
It depends. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, I've seen a
variety of responses. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but we were really trying to surprise the audience because I think we all know what a show like this could have fallen into, a ripoff of Deep Space Nine or something,
right.
You know?
Right. I think it was almost like, because it is like the book. The book is like almost an anthology of short stories, although it is the same characters more or less. And like the book, characters come and go. And it's interconnected stories, but it is like short stories. They are, each one feels different in tone, indeed. Yeah.
Right. So that was part of going back to what I said earlier, that was mm-hmm. part of Hugh's original approach.
Right.
So that was a device for us. And then, and I do believe let me say this first. So that was mm-hmm. a thing. And also when Hugh and I talked, you know, he really wanted episodes like the Barbara Hershey episode, you know, just right. two people talking, you know, he really mm-hmm. wanted, he felt like that yeah. was it. Not so much.
That was one of my favorites of the whole series. Yeah.
Thanks. So it was, you know, so that was the target, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what was important and what the challenge was all of these episodes, I considered every episode, you know, what was important to the characters, what was the emotional journey, what does it feel like? You know, mm-hmm. I think every episode we worked very hard to make sure it had a good ending, that it drove right. you into the next episode. I do think we stuck all the landings. Mm-hmm. But we also really thought about how do you build out this world? Not so much make it a complicated mythology, but how do you keep building out this world?
Mm-hmm.
So say in the young Aster episode, right, when she, you know, is the teenager and she comes back or whatever, you know, that's building out, you know, what is her experience with her family? What, you know, we've seen the family, but what yeah. you know, what happened, you know, after she left the beacon, before she came back, how did she get into
the QTA and everything?
The QTA. Yeah. So, you know, we really tried to look at the world building and you know, that was important to us.
So one thing that Luke and I really loved is the way that you worked the actress Ellen Wong's personal information into her character. You know, the fact that she used to play the clarinet, the fact that she speaks Teochew. I was wondering, were you able to do that with any other characters as well?
Not the personal character, not their personal background. You know, I will say that we spent a lot of time, you know, here's how we worked on the characters. Like, let's say with Barbara and Eric Lang for their episode, we spent a lot of time just discussing. That was a great experience. We spent a lot of time discussing that script. We would talk through mm-hmm. the script. We would read it a little bit. We would ask questions. Why is my character saying this? Why is the character saying that? We kind of talked that through, right? So that was all positive. Mm-hmm. I think with Natasha, with Harmony, you know, we really felt she was kind of, you know, she had roles in season one, but we felt, you know, she was a star and we wanted to go to her more. So in season two, we went to her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Dev was originally a character that was sort of written out of the show.
Right.
And then we
just love the actor. Yeah.
Yeah, we love the actor and brought them back. Yeah. And then there was one of the actors, I think his name was Prince. One of the actors who played one of the Sabarans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you know, was an amputee, and he was a poor guy.
I
had
know
suffered.
Him from Station 11. Yeah.
Yes. And so, when, you know, he came in and read an audition, I said, well, this is interesting because that says something about the Sabarans. If one of their folks had been in an accident and they cared for him and everything, mm-hmm. and he was able to kind of fit in. So we kind of used his personal story there and kind of gave it to the character, you know, to an extent. So I guess we did use that, but really with Ellen, you know, we wanted to kind of think about, well, she was prepared to live in isolation. And so, you know, the idea of, we asked, do you play an instrument? I forget what instrument we originally had. And she said, well, I do play clarinet. So, so she's playing. That's her playing. That's not just her fingering. I mean, that's actually her recording. And then we use that recording, you know, so she learned that piece and everything, you know, she's speaking the language that she speaks with her family. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, called Teochew. Mm-hmm. And so that's a dialect that she speaks. So we use that.
That's really cool. And on the character front,
I'm sorry. Is my dog driving you crazy? Can you?
Oh
hear
no,
that?
No, no. It's fine. I can barely hear it. And yeah, it's listeners are used to hearing my cats, so it's, okay. What are you gonna do?
I apologize.
And my co-hosts have kids, and yeah. But yeah, Iris was definitely one of our favorite characters because she was so specific. She's someone that I would definitely want to know more about. But I have a question from my co-host Luke. He asked me to ask you. How much Milan is left in Aleph? Speaking of character.
That's interesting. I feel there's more Milan than you would believe. I believe Joy would say that Milan was sort of destroyed by Aleph, that Milan gave, you know, this was a conversation that we would have. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel that a lot of the show was about questions of humanity, holding on to humanity. So, but I felt like the some of the things that were in the original script for the last episode, I think Joy felt that perhaps, you know, he still existed, but had been reduced to almost nothing. I think there's a little bit more.
Okay. And I have to ask, am I to understand, did Aster, when we met her in the flashback, she and her friend had started a kind of group, and it sounded like there were a lot of different groups who were opposing what was going on with the QTA and the military and everything. Are we meant to understand that these groups formed into the column?
No, I would say the column was probably a different group. It could be that, but I felt like the column was a different group that started out and sort of, you know, gained strength elsewhere. I think this splinter group that Aster was a part of was probably wiped out. You know, that was something that was interesting that, I think it was in your podcast that you were, very, really questioning the double cliffhangers.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, it wasn't, right? I actually did not have a problem with the Aster cliffhanger, but that was one that I noticed divided people, because for me, I did say in the podcast, after that episode, because it was back to back cliffhangers. And I said, I think they're going to pick up, with the, you know, the present timeline, the Sabarans. And I think that, I don't really need to have Aster's story continued personally, because I just thought it, you know, this leads to her joining the QTA. I was glad to hear you clarified in the interview with Three Hosts and a Beacon that the timeline, that this happened before she joined the QTA. So Harmony wasn't with her yet. That's why she wasn't there.
That's correct. So this was filling in a gap in her history, and I didn't really see it as a cliffhanger. You know what I'm saying? I thought it was very clear what comes next.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't see it as a cliffhanger, but I do think, you know, QTA arrives, you know, she's arrested. She goes, she's brought into QTA. She meets Harmony. And then later, you know, she meets, you know, her friend, I forget the friend's name or whatever. So,
right.
So you go on that journey. I believe that the female pilot was probably imprisoned. I think the prisoner, they probably turned loose. They probably did lock up the beacon keeper. You know, I think it's a cynical ending.
Right.
That sort of, you know, that was important because she's shifting from, she's shifting from idealism to the beacon keeper, the older beacon keeper cynicism. Cause I do think that her character, her adult character is cynical, you know, and sort of broken or whatever. So I just felt like that was a piece there to fill out.
Okay. And speaking of cynicism, Dev, now I was wondering, so Harmony took a little bit of a dark turn erasing Dev, but then she said to Dev, you will no longer be AI. But Luke and I were wondering, does that mean that Dev might still exist in some form of code?
I would want Dev to exist. I felt that Dev was interesting. And so how Dev would change, I would say Dev probably changed in some type of some, because a lot of the show is about adaptation too. It's about resilience. It's about that. So you can see, so we don't really believe people die in a way, you know what I mean? Or they move on or they change. So I would say if we did another season, I would want to see Dev again. I thought that actor was terrific.
Yeah. Why? I thought Dev was a lot of fun to watch as a character. We called Dev the walking HR violation, but
yeah, exactly.
It just felt that like he, was personifying, or, you know, in AI terms, a character trait of, you know, someone who's just really desperate for love. And we know real people like that. So I saw real people in Dev, which I found very interesting.
Yes.
Like, but how would you describe imprinting as working? Because it seemed like obviously it worked differently for Dev and Harmony, but I feel like that's a difference in mental health rather than technical terms.
Yeah, with the imprinting, we just sort of felt like it was kind of, you know, some type of psychic bond, and we think like Dev's dark side sort of made Dev a type of vampire. We described that, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Discuss that. Yeah.
Yeah. And the final forms that we see with Harmony at the end, like, are those real slivers or of the actual person? Like, was it really Astor? Was it really Bart? Or are those reflections of those people in Harmony?
I would say it's some type of reflection, because I'm not exactly clear. You know, this was one of those things about what is that netherworld space at the end? Where exactly are they? Where, how is it happening? So I do think that it's, in a way, it's a type of the imprinting, right? Because we did say that Harmony imprinted or had emotional connections with everybody.
Right.
So I would say that it has to do, you know, and to me, the ending is the ending clear? Did you get what the ending was the alien?
I mean, yeah. So my interpretation of the ending, and please correct me if I'm misinterpreting any of it, is that so we have this kind of super being that's Harmony with these reflections of other people, let's say, of these people she's bonded with. And this creates a sort of more well-rounded, complete being, which is what the alien, which I heard you called it the Riff, which is what they're called in the book. That the Riff wants someone, they want someone that they can feel safe around, which Luke and I found a little ominous too.
Yes. I mean, it's, you know, eugenics. It's, that is not a good thing, you know? So, so to say that the what is Olive seeking? Olive is seeking some kind of union, or has achieved some kind of union with AI, right? And the question is AI versus humanity, and you know, and you have different forms of that. Okay, we see different forms. Bart is one form, Harmony's another, Olive's another, Dev's another. So, and we see different types of humans. So to you know, think about that the aliens, so if we say that the aliens, that the alien, the Riffs are an ancient race who something went wrong, okay? So they're forced to, you know, maybe they were, there was a war, maybe they were, you know, maybe these are refugees themselves, whatever, they're hiding in this pocket universe, okay? Right. And they're close, you know, this they're close to the beacon. They see what's going on and they realize, okay, we want contact. Maybe it's not sustainable to live in this pocket universe. We want contact. But if we contact any of these people, they're going to eliminate us, you know?
Right.
So we have to sort of fuse them together and cherry pick the best qualities and evolve them in a way that we could have communion. Yeah, I think that's a very interesting, complex story. You know, that story does track over all of the two seasons. I was very excited about that ending. I think that was cool.
I was very excited about it too. So of course we have to ask: is season three still on the table? Is there any?
Well, I would let MGM Plus talk about that. I think they've been a great partner and stuff, but I don't feel like I'm in a position to respond to that. I would love to do season three because, you know, I would love to. I don't want to give anything away, but there is more story.
Right. Or would there be another possibility of a continuation, if not like a comic book or something?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I could talk to Hugh about that. That's actually interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
That would be cool. I have to give credit to Luke. He's the one who requested that.
Yeah, that's actually a good idea.
I have to ask about Iris. She seems to be the only one that wasn't really affected in any way by the artifact. Is there a reason for that? Or is she just not there long enough? Or is she too like determined?
Yeah, I think she just wasn't there. She just wasn't there long enough. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And she has no personal history with it. The other two, but you know, if you feel like the artifact draws people there for a reason, you know, I would say that that would probably be what was Iris's role in it. I would explore that in a future story.
Yeah, I would love to also, I would love to learn more about her background and, you know, what makes her so pathologically helpful. Like it just, she seems like that's core to who she is.
Well, part of the thing was, you know, there was a version of the story. There was a version, and I think there was a correction there. I think Iris was needed. If you look at some of the early episodes, okay, there was a lot of sniping between characters.
Right.
Okay. So when, you know, the wreckers come in. Now, obviously, they're a band of pirates, so they're not going to be that kind to each other. But it was just the tone was a lot of sniping. You know, when Coley comes in, there was a lot of sniping. You know what I mean? So there was always like that. You know, there were so I think we just felt like we had that tone covered,
right?
And we sort of needed a breath of fresh air.
Which,
you know, it was getting, it was feeling, in a way, it was, especially after, you know, the events of the second season premiere, it was feeling very, you know, literally everybody was at everybody else's throats. So we thought, who's the last person who should be on the beacon right now?
Right.
You know, a force of good. Someone who bakes, you know, someone who does this, someone who plays the clarinet, you know, like she's the last person that would show up. So, okay, let's throw her in there and see what happens, you know?
I have to ask, there was no GWB this season. They were getting high on it last season like they do in the books. I would have been curious how Iris would have reacted to that. How do you think Iris would have reacted?
That's interesting. I think she would have probably You know how you have some people who you know get drunk once or you know try drugs and then they kind of lose their mind and then they get scared and say that's not for me. I think she'd be like that. I think she's not a you know I think she would be curious, but then I don't think it would be good for her. I don't think she would want to lose that much control. She's not about losing control.
Right. Okay. I have to ask a question from a friend of the pod, Stu, Dube71, said, so he has a military background, by the way, and so he has questions about the military side of the world building. He was wondering, is this galaxy or this world, this universe, in a constant state of civil war, or is it just isolated colonies with elements of dominant factions causing issues?
I would say it's the latter. I would say I would not say it's civil war. We purposefully did not want to have, I think that's a science fiction trope, forces of good, forces of evil. You know, we did not want this to be like Foundation, Game of Thrones in space. We did not want a lot of opposing forces. So we wanted sort of just a, you know, all of slow takeover, and you have these pockets of ill-equipped resistance. But so it was definitely that.
Okay. And I have to ask for myself, the spores that, you know, got into Halen's brain and everything, is that part of the Rif aliens, or is that like a something they use to communicate?
I would say that was something they used to communicate. I don't think that was not like little alien spores or whatever. I would say that was something that they had, you know, that came from the artifact that was all kind of the same color and all of that. So I would say that was their technology in some way.
Okay. And if I'm not mistaken, Rocky looked different this season, right? More blue.
Where did you see Rocky in season two?
Oh, well, the Lipit, I guess it wasn't necessarily Rocky, the thing that the rock that Halen had in the tin that he was carrying around that got passed around a bit and then flew out.
That is a piece. That's supposed to be a piece that he that's not Rocky from season one. That's supposed to be a piece of the artifact that was in the airlock when he re-entered after jettisoning Aster into the artifact. When he comes in, the airlock's been punctured and there's material floating around right before he meets Olive in the final confrontation in 201. So when he comes in and so it's supposed to be like dust there, and he's got a little piece of what he thinks is Aster or something like that. That's where that came from.
Okay, but I guess Rocky probably rejoined the artifact.
He did. We saw that when they opened the thing and Rocky went up.
That makes sense. Yeah. So Luke also asked, what's one thing that you would change in either season of the show?
That's a great question. I think knowing where we end up, I would look at some of the stuff. And there's an episode where there's like the temperature is dropping.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then you have, you know, so the middle of season two, right? I think season two gets off to a strong start. We introduce Iris, but then we have this the temperature is dropping. The Sabarans show up. We have we go back and do the Aster flashback, and then we have the military arriving. So it's probably one too many curveballs in that thing. I like the ending, but it's probably, you know, so I guess if I was to do it over again, I would probably this is a great question. So let's think about this. Part of the reason that the Aster flashback exists, right, is to kind of reintroduce the concept of Aster, because we know that Lena was coming back for the finale, right? So we kind of wanted to put her on the audience's radar, right? That's one thing. And we wanted to, I felt it was important to sort of establish how this military treats this, their soldiers with these false memories and that sort of stuff. Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if the flashback was the best way to do that. And so I like that episode. Mm-hmm. Or perhaps
I like that episode.
Okay, so let's keep that episode. So then I would look at the other pieces. So maybe you would move that flashback somewhere. Maybe you would move it elsewhere in the season. But let's say you don't. Mm-hmm. So then I think the one thing I never really understood was the plasma and like the cold and that stuff. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know what I mean? So I didn't understand that. Like who was generating that? Where was that coming from? What was that about? So I would kind of look at the material that's ramping up into the finale. Because I think the finale is emotional. I think it's great to see Lena's character back, all of that. Mm-hmm. You know, it comes to a head, and I do like the ending with the Riff alien and the revelation. Right. But I would say after Iris's introduction, just before, you know, those episodes, I would just kind of want to, I feel like we have kind of a cluster of mythology there, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure what the emotional through line is that we're asking the audience to go for that ride.
Okay.
So I would want to kind of, you know, put those episodes back on the board and say, mm-hmm. what is the emotional story we're telling there?
Right.
You
right.
know, so it's just that, because I get it at the end and I get it here, but then I sort of lose the thread a little bit. So I'm being very candid. You know, you usually don't talk about something like that.
Yeah, no, I very appreciate it.
Yeah, so I would just want to kind of look at that.
Yeah, it offers a lot of insight also to people, just of the complicated decisions you have to make to make these shows happen, particularly with things like the strike involved and things like that. But just in general, how do you plan these things out?
It's so incredibly complex. You know, mm-hmm. I'm working on a show now, right? Which I'm not,
right.
you know, can't privy to say. But my sons, you know, when they're in town, okay, the one lives in New York and the other one's actually working in Canada right now. And then the mm-hmm. third one is at school. And so when they're in town, two of them have come to my office and kind of sat in the writer's room.
Yeah.
And they said they had no idea how much you discuss, how much the writers discuss every scene. Is it this? Is it that? It could be thousands of times.
Right.
You know what I mean? It could be like the stuff does not just get thrown together. So these conversations, you know, the different, you know, number of drafts. I'm a big rewriter, that kind of stuff. I can't tell you how many different versions of the episodes I cut in season one.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. let's try it this way, let's try it that way, that kind of stuff. So what's important is always, you know, what is the emotional impact we want to have on the audience? And sometimes, you know, and I think the intent of the show was to simplify this mythology, keep a lot of it off screen and stay with these core characters. But if you look at some of season two, you have a lot of mythology coming in the front door.
Right.
So maybe, you know, if Ellen's character, you know, Iris was fresh eyes, maybe kind of put her in the, like, I really do like in the Sabaran episode where she and Halen have different viewpoints about what to do with the Sabarans mm-hmm. and Dosto. Right. Like I like that kind of stuff. Okay. What are they trying to work out? I like that part of the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Well, I think, the relationships between the characters have been one of the strongest things about the show throughout. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know you have limited time left, so I have two quick questions for you.
Please.
One is, if there is a season three or some other sort of continuation, obviously the story will continue on the beacon itself, but would there also be glimpses inside this pocket universe?
Oh, that's interesting. It could be. That's actually interesting. Yeah. Maybe. I'll steal that from you. Okay.
Please do. Please do. Okay. And the last one is a super silly question. Luke and I like to play this game called Join, Jail, Jettison. So I give you three characters and you say which one is going to be your companion in your space journeys, which one needs to go to jail, and which one's getting thrown out of the airlock.
Okay, great. And, okay.
And assuming if they are AI that they can be thrown out the airlock. So we've got Aster, Halen, Aleph.
Okay. I think I would join Aster. I think she's resourceful, and I think I would join her. I think I would. I don't know if I would. Who I would? I would probably. Yeah, I would probably jail Halen, and then in case of emergency, break glass and get him out of jail. So
okay. And jettison. So you're pulling Aleph, an Aleph, yeah.
and then I would jettison Aleph just because he's clearly going to kill me at some point.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. Anyone who's not Aleph must die. Well. Thank you so much for being game and for your openness and candidness during this. It's really so insightful with the show and with, you know, the work you do in general. So,
thank you so much. This is really a lot of fun. Thank you for having me.
And that was my discussion with Glenn Matsara. He wanted me to add that he really appreciates the care and attention to detail that fans have brought to the series. So not only Luke and I breaking it down, but also you as listeners and all the thoughtful questions and insights and interest. Now, I'll let you process what we discussed over a quick break, and then Luke and I will be back with our response and a couple final thoughts from the community for now. So, Luke, you got a chance to listen to my discussion with Glenn Matsara. What did you think?
I thought the thing that struck me most was he's incredibly honest. Doing these interviews, because like the question I asked about what would you change, I thought, you know, he might sort of waffle on that a bit, but I thought he was incredibly sort of open and honest about what he thought worked and what he thought didn't. I thought the discussion of the relationship between him and Joy Blake was really interesting in terms of, you know, bringing on almost an apprentice, bringing on somebody who, you know, helping somebody sort of navigate their way through running a show, which when you actually sort of sit down and read about these things, it always sounds like a completely impossible job for one person to do. So I thought that was really interesting. I thought the discussion about, Beacon 19 and COVID was really striking, because obviously isolation and loneliness are a theme of the show, but I never really thought about it in relation to COVID-19. And yet when he said it, it's like, that's completely obvious, but it's not something that had sort of occurred to me. And we sort of talked about the dream logic of the show and in our last episode, but I thought it was really interesting that he was sorry, we're recording this in two parts. So I'm getting a little bit confused. We talked about the dream logic of the show. I thought that was really interesting, and almost like what he wanted the audience to take away from the show more than anything else was the vibe of it, the feel of it, rather than the plot. And it's like, yeah, I'd have to go back and watch both seasons, because it's just, you know, it's one of those things, you get out of the show what you bring to it. And I'm very sort of, I tend to watch shows in a very plot orientated way. I'm not very good at watching things like Mulholland Drive or something like, I remember the
Twin
first
Peaks.
Time Twin Peaks or something like Pi, the Darren Aronofsky. I can remember a friend of mine showing that to me, and all I got was really irritated. irritated by it, because I just wanted to know what was going on. I have a sort of tendency to watch shows, to watch movies for plot rather than the atmosphere, the mise-en-scène of the thing. But yeah, I thought that was really interesting. I like the fact he's going to go and talk to Hugh Howey about whether they could do a follow up, a graphic novel, if they don't get another series. So yes, if there is a graphic novel, I want acknowledgement.
Yes,
I want acknowledgement in that. But yeah, I thought that the discussion was really interesting. It's incredibly nice of him to give over that much time to, you know, just a podcast about his work. I thought it was incredibly generous of him.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. I really appreciate it. Really appreciate his openness. I enjoyed talking about the delicate art of showrunning in general. And I hope that it gives people a little extra perspective when thinking about television in general, because, you know, when talking about, it doesn't have to be an adaptation, but when talking about any TV show, I think often fans are not realistic about the challenges and the budget and the time, and, you know, especially when extra wrenches are thrown into the works, like strikes or actors leaving, you know. And I also appreciated, you and I have talked a lot about on this podcast about how we really like to see the old guard bringing up the new guard under their wings in terms of especially writing and directing. We've talked about a lot. So it's good to hear that he has this relationship with Joy Blake.
Yeah. And I thought that the other thing about that was the writer's strike. That must be absolute agony if you're a showrunner, because it's like, yeah, the idea that other people are working on my show, my material, right, but I can't see or have anything to do with that. Yeah. That must be so difficult. Mm-hmm. And like Glenn Mazzara is obviously not alone in that, but that would drive me absolutely insane. That must be really difficult.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so I'm glad to hear that he was very happy when he came back with what they came back with. And, you know, he talked specifically about that creature design, which I think turned out great. And by the way, you were right about them being reflections of Harmony in the end.
Yeah. Yeah, I did do a little like fist, listening to it this morning, I did do a little like fist bump. Score one.
Important question here. Do you agree with his join jail jettison, or would you have gone a different route?
No, I think I would have gone with the, you can't not, like you say, you've got to have the break in case of emergency jettison for Aleph. Like, Aleph, I'd like to.
Well, you said break in case of emergency, Halen's in jail.
Yeah, Halen, I'm sorry, yes. yeah. Like, this is the thing, I'd like to have a conversation with Aleph, but I'd like to know that I can switch him off at any point, because I find Aleph a fascinating character, but he's clearly going to try and kill me at some point.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess if you could jail Aleph, is that even possible?
Yeah, is that even possible?
So I saw some news that's potentially worrying, that, you know, obviously Glenn Mazzara didn't want to go into what MGM might be saying or planning behind the scenes in terms of renewal, but there was something that popped up on Reddit about a prop sale in Toronto. And so when I went and looked at it, and it does have a bunch of Beacon 23 props in it. Like, it has the 3D printer. It has some of the spacesuits that they were wearing. So I don't know if that means anything. There was also a bunch of stuff in The Expanse, from The Expanse in there too. So I don't know if that means anything, but just pointing it out, it's looking grim. So I hope we do get that comic book or something like that. That would be fun.
Yeah, I mean, we were kind of always operating on the assumption it would be two seasons right, and done. Mm-hmm. And I think reading between the lines, I think everybody in the show was kind of operating on that assumption as well. Not that they didn't.
I mean, there's no guarantees at least beyond that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel okay personally now with this being the end, this transcendence. Though, yeah, again, I'll keep my fingers crossed for some sort of written continuation if that manages to happen. How are you feeling though about this?
No, I'm sorry. I want to know what the riff wants to say. I want to know what the message is. I'm with Aleph. Right. I'm with Aleph on this one. I want to know. I want to know what the message is.
Okay. Okay. Fair. Yeah. But did the conversation with Glamatar reframe any of your thoughts about the show?
It did, in the sense that like I say, he seemed like, and I'm not saying this is a bad thing in any way. You just seem more invested in the vibes and the themes of the show rather than the sort of linear plot of it. And yeah, I think if I go back and watch Beacon 23, I think particularly probably the earlier episodes, I think it would probably be worthwhile to watch them, you know, with that in mind rather than sort of focusing on the, you know, the who, why, what of the plot. Because yes, he wasn't showrunner in season one, but he was heavily involved in the interview. He was doing a lot of the editing for it. Mm-hmm. So
Well, shall we have a couple quick final thoughts from the community? Shall we check in with them?
Absolutely.
The Quantum Tunneler has new messages.
So first of all, I have to shout out to at HanWagu9967, who commented on the video on YouTube, who said, "I think you both have it wrong about what we said about the finale. I think you both have it wrong. The main character has actually been Harmony. If you view Harmony as the main character, it all makes more sense." What do you think?
Actually, I think there's some truth in that. Mm-hmm. I think Harmony is definitely the main character for season two.
Right.
And sort of Glamatar sort of hinted at this, that, you know, they'd sort of seen Natasha Mumba's work in season one and thought, you know, she was the real sort of breakout star of the show. So they were gonna have a bigger role for her in season two. So I think that's definitely true of season two. I don't think it's true in season one. I think Asta is the star in you know, the main protagonist in the first season.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, from the perspective of a writer, when you write, it often emerges that something else is the case. And you might find out as you're writing a novel or something like that, that the main character is not who you initially thought it was. So I interpret it like that. So maybe they didn't think Harmony was the main character in the first season, but when they looked back on the first season and how it connects into the second season and everything together, then they're like, oh, wait, actually, it's been Harmony all along.
And I think a lot of that has to do with Natasha Mumba's performance, particularly like the subtlety of her performance, because she's trying to like convey, particularly in season one, she's trying to convey sort of strong emotion while at the same time being this AI that isn't meant to feel strong emotion. So I think in the hands of a different actor, Harmony's role could have gone in very different directions. So props to Natasha Mumba for that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that her versatility, you know, as you said, the way she can convey the emergence of emotion, basically, you know, where, as you said, she can do that snap to that blank AI state. But then also at the same time, in between that, she's struggling with like, wait, is this anger that I feel? Is this sadness? What is this? Oh, these emotions are rough work, or whatever she said to after at the end.
Yeah.
All right. Shall we check in with Duve for his last thoughts?
Yeah.
So Stu, aka Duve71, said, "Finally got to watch the end of the season. Both myself and the good lady Shelley agreed that it's been a bit of a mixed bag this season. Some seeming jumps to get us to the end. Weird choices by protagonists, characters introduced that didn't help drive the narrative forward, and why have that episode with young Aster?" Well, I think, yeah, the episode with young Aster now has been discussed with length, so I hope, Stu, let us know if you are satisfied with that discussion, with that answer. Stu continues, "With the short season, I felt the writing needed to be tight, but for some reason it felt a bit meandering." Yeah, we also discussed that in the interview. "I may feel differently after a bit of a ponder, but my predominant feeling at the moment is that I preferred season one."
I don't know that it may. I mean, Stu, you're obviously entitled to your opinion, but I've never, because they were shot back to back, and because the gap between the two seasons was so short. I've never really seen Beacon 23 as having two seasons. I've always sort of thought of it more as a sort of 16 episode single season run, to be honest.
Right.
And it's strange to think that even though it does have different showrunners, I never got, and I think this speaks to the level of cooperation and sort of collaborative working. I never really felt like there was a huge shift in tone between season one and season two. There were some tweaks.
Well, it's because Matsuura and Blake were involved in season one heavily too, so that makes it, you know.
Yeah.
And they saw it across the finish line season one, so
yeah,
they're really the ones who kept it.
I've always sort of thought of it as sort of a 16 episode single seasonal. I've always thought of it sort of one season with a little break in the middle rather than two seasons.
No, I agree. When I look back on these two seasons or one two-part season, however you want to think of it, I can't say I prefer one over the other. I do have favorite episodes within that. Like I said in the interview, the Barbara Hershey episode I've always said is one of my favorites from this season. I especially loved the Purgatory, the QTA headquarters, and the Iris introduction episodes. I also really liked the flashback Young Astor episode was a favorite of mine too.
Have I got favorite episodes? Again, this is possibly because of how I watched it, because I tended to watch them in like, you know, two episodes back to back or three episodes back to back. But I never really thought of it as an eight. And I think because it is sort of telling one story over two seasons, I never really thought of it in episodic. I never really thought of it in episodic terms either, to be honest. But again, I think that has a lot to do with how I was watching it, because I wasn't watching them as, you know, one episode a week. I was watching them as, you know, two episodes back to back or three episodes back to back. So it's actually quite difficult to work out where I know what happened, but actually putting different events in different episodes is actually quite difficult. I just don't stop and think.
Okay. Well, do you have any final thoughts about the series as it stands overall?
I mean, I would like, whether it be season three, whether it be a graphic novel, whether it be, you know, what used to be called a made-for-TV movie is the on-demand thing. I would like some sort of continuation of it, because I think, like, as Glenn Matsuura was saying in the interview, you know, there is story left there. There is story left there to tell. I think in terms of did it achieve what Glenn Matsuura wanted to achieve, or what he was explaining in that interview? Yes, I think it did. I think it really did tap into those themes of loneliness and isolation, and the idea that you know, the idea that what makes life worth living ultimately is other people and the relationships you have with them. I think it did that well. I think I'd be interested to see a version of Beacon 23 that had a bigger budget than this had. Because
As he said, they did have a bigger budget than you might expect, because there was a lot of CGI, especially with the space.
But I think the bigger budget point is I'd like to see more of the universe.
But I'm not sure that that's what this show is, because, and I say this with a book bias, because the book is very much like, it's about the beacon and the people who stop by the beacon and what happens in this random outpost in the universe.
I mean, that was a question I had for you as the book reader of the two of us, because at the beginning of that interview, Glenn Matsuura talks about the process
of intent.
The author's intent and the process of adaptation. So we've said basically from the first episode of the podcast that the TV series takes, you know, huge, you know, goes off in different directions from the book. But do you think it stayed true to Hugh Howey's intent?
Yes. I think Hugh Howey said that as well. He's like, well, this is more interested in exploring AI than his book was. AI is not, it's just, there happens to be AI helping helping the book version of Halen run the beacon, but it's not this major character like in the show. So that's something that the book added. But I think what Glenn Matsara meant with that is this idea of it being a sort of almost a dreamy anthology of stuff that happens in this, this outpost in the universe. And then the show added some more to that, like the artifact. Instead of there just being Rocky, there's the artifact. But it's like I said, it's wrapping back around where aliens called the Riff have just shown up. So yeah, I do wonder if they continued, if they might end up with the same ending as the book, which again, I'm not going to ruin that ending right here. If anyone wants to know what that ending is, well, I recommend reading the book, or you can listen to the breakdown of the book that Abby and I did in the book club.
Okay. So have you got any final thoughts on, the show?
I'm feeling satisfied with where it is. Of course, I want more, but like, you know, if that doesn't happen, I have come to terms with that. I think this was a good little jaunt into space. I loved the cast. Of course, it's always great to see Lena Headey, but it's also, I got to know some new actors that I'm going to be looking out for in other projects to come.
Mm.
So very excited about that. Do you think you'll read the book now?
No. I pulled a bit of a face. Probably not, because, and that's no reflection on Hugh Howie, but like, because I've seen the show before I've read the book, I think I'd be constantly trying to impose the show on the
book. But the book does give you an ending if you're craving that.
Okay. Maybe.
Mm-hmm. I recommend it. It's only, like I said, it's only 180 pages. Like, you can read it in a couple days.
Okay.
All right. Well, with that, our Beacon 23 coverage comes to a close, for now at least. For the Silo fans, we'll be back in August with an update about what we learn at San Diego Comic-Con. And in the meantime, stay subscribed for Dune. We're going to be covering first the book in four parts. So the book is divided into three parts. So we're going to cover each of those separately and then have a fourth part where we go over everybody's rankings for the most iconic scenes from Dune.
I love this because it started out as two parts, then it's gone to three parts, now it's gone to four.
I realized by trying to like make these book episodes one thing, I'm just creating more work and stress for myself. So like if Frank Herbert wrote it in three separate parts,
we're going to review it in three separate parts. Yeah.
Author intent.
Yeah.
And I think actually David might be joining us for that. So yeah, stay tuned. David from the Lorehounds, for anyone who might not know. And if you enjoyed this, if you enjoy what we do in this podcast in general, it's always a massive help if you can share this with any friends who might enjoy it, if you can leave any 5-star reviews wherever you're listening. And we also definitely want to hear from you directly. Now, you can email the podcast at woolshiftdustpodcast@gmail.com. You'll find that link in the show notes. And Luke, where can they find you?
So they can find me at Luke Midup on Twitter and the same handle on Blue Sky. I also record another podcast called It Could Be Said with Simon Alvey and Will Cooling, two friends of mine from college. We talk about British politics, we talk about culture, we talk about sport. Obviously, we're doing a lot of politics at the moment because the UK is in the midst of a general election. So we're recording the next episode, I think, this afternoon. That's Sunday, the 23rd of June. That should be out Monday or Tuesday.
Okay. And you can find me at Alicia CB on all kinds of social media. I've been getting more involved on Threads. There's some good conversation going on there. But yeah, you can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky and all the stuff. And you'll find all these links in the show notes, including the book club where the second shift is. So the second part of the book shift, which is the second book in the Silo series. The breakdown for that is going to be out in the book club shortly, a couple days after this. And This episode was produced by me and published by the Lorehounds, where on the Lorehounds feed, you can also find House of the Dragon. Full coverage is going on now, and you can sign up for a season pass if you want extra weekly episodes that drop right after the episode comes out, and also a show guide that John and David have made. And you'll also find me on the episodes on the Lorehounds covering Doctor Who, weekly breakdowns of The Acolyte, and there's also an MC Universe episode that just came out where Jean and I talk about Marvel news and X-Men, and we rank all of the Fox Marvel movies from worst to best. No points for guessing which we both had as number one.
Yeah. Oh, just to say, while you were talking about the Acolyte, not episode 4, but episode 3.
Yeah.
One of the witches was somebody I followed on social media for a really long time.
Oh.
A woman called Abigail Thorne, who her YouTube channel is something called Philosophy Tube.
Okay.
And she does, it's basically a breakdown of different philosophers and their work. And it's really cool because it started out as these little 10-minute YouTube shorts.
Right.
And it got more and more popular. And now they're like these hour-long productions with costumes and special effects. And yeah. And she's a trans woman, and she's spoken very publicly and very movingly on her platforms about that experience. So yeah, it was Leo Point. She's only got like three lines, I counted them, but it's like Leo pointing me. It's not like I know her. It's like it's the obvious like parasocial relationship, but it was
right.
It was really cool. Just go, that's happening.
Well, thank you for pointing that out, because obviously, you know, the trolls are mad that there's somebody trans in the cast. But on the plus side, so this is the first trans woman or trans actor, I guess. We don't know anything about the character, but this is the first trans woman who's in a speaking role on Star Wars. So I did not know about the YouTube stuff, though. So
yeah,
thank you.
Check it out. The YouTube channel is Philosophy Tube. If you have a Nebula membership as well, she's on there, and I would recommend, if you've got the choice, watch it on Nebula, because there are extras, and it's the kind of thing that works better without adverts to break up the flow of it. So, yeah, if you have a Nebula membership, use that as well.
Okay. Yeah, so in addition to the Acolyte coverage on the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast and the bonus episode that recently released for the Canon Padawan Supercast and the Lorehounds Patreon and Supercast subscribers, there will also be another episode coming next week on the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast feed for Star Wars fans or for just the Star Wars curious, because this one is, I'm jumping back to the very beginning of the timeline. And I'm going to be talking about two canon ancient myths in the Star Wars universe set before 30,000 BBY, linked to the planet of Batuu. So these are from a difficult-to-find canon book of myths that I recently finally got my hands on. And I'm going to break down these two myths for the curious, what they contain and what they mean for the wider lore.
Oh, just to say one more thing about Abby, because it came out on her feed. She's also going to be in...
And Abby is... we don't mean our Abby. We mean
Abigail Thorne.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's also going to be in Hot D. She is playing... Oh, okay. She's playing something to do with the Triarchy, although she's been very tight-lipped about what exactly.
Okay.
But yeah, a character associated with the Triarchy.
Oh, I like to see it thriving.
Yeah.
I also want to shout out the other affiliates on the Lorehounds Network. So Rings and Rituals is just wrapping up the season one recap of Rings of Power, prepping for season two, which begins in August. And Radioactive Ramblings is in the middle of their weekly The Boys coverage. Plus, they are also continuing their episodes about Fallout lore for people who want more context for that show and those games. And also Properly Howard just finished their Felonies and Fugazi season. So funny movie reviews. You don't have to watch the movies. Just enjoy yourself. And please do join us on our Discord to discuss all of this and a whole bunch more things. Luke, do you have any final words?
No, I think that's it.
All right. Well, we'll be back with more Dune coverage soon, right after we synthesize our consciousnesses so that we may become less threatening to a jellyfish-like race of interdimensional aliens.
This summer, we enter a new era of Star Wars.
You mean the Dawn of the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast?
Yeah, sure, that too. But I was obviously talking about The Acolyte. We've got to cover that on the Lorehounds.
Oh, but the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast is exactly at that point in the timeline, the end of the High Republic, 100 years before the prequel trilogy. We've got to cover it there.
Why not both?
Okay, deal.
It's the first live-action Star Wars outside the Skywalker saga. Nobody can miss this.
Listeners, kick off your hot lore summer weekends with scene-by-scene breakdowns of The Acolyte, found in both the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast and the Lorehounds Mother feed.
And the Lorehounds Star Wars feed.
Wherever you like to listen, a couple of days after each new episode is released.